Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, March 13th. I'm Ray Graff. President Trump says he'll meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in May. It'll be the first meeting between a sitting American president and the head of the reclusive regime. To make matters even more interesting, Mike Pompeo will replace Rex Tillerson, we find out today, as Secretary of State. One White House official said the president wants to have a new team in place ahead of the upcoming North Korean talks. We have experts here from Siena College, Union College, and the University at Albany to help us sort the whole thing out. To join the conversation, call 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you may email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. North Korea today on Vox Pop, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In for Alan Shartok, President Trump says he'll meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in May. It would be the first meeting between a sitting U.S. president and the head of North Korea. And in a move today that was shocking to some extent, but not really, as it has probably been coming for some time. President Trump fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and said he would nominate CIA Director Mike Pompeo. "We disagreed on things," Trump said moments later. The move comes amid this dramatic diplomatic opening with North Korea, and the president set to hold the meeting in May. Well, we'll try to sort all this out for you today. We have three great guests in the studio. Leonard Cutler is a political science professor at Siena College. He has written several books and articles on the president's war powers, the use of electronic surveillance, and the use of drone technology in the fight against terrorism. Mark Dallas is an associate professor at Union College. He specializes in international and comparative political economics, as well as East Asia. And Nolan Farenkopf is a doctoral candidate in the political science department at the University at Albany. His dissertation focuses on the proliferation of conventional missile systems and how it affects the ability of dominant states to project power. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming in the lousy weather.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
And if you want to join in the conversation, the number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Or you can email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. I guess we'll start this way. If there's one thing that we know of the Trump presidency, is it's fairly unpredictable. Could any of you at this table have predicted that there would be a planned meeting face-to-face between a U.S. president and North Korean leader at this juncture in history?
Not I must confess.
No. All right, Len. Mark?
No, absolutely not. This is unprecedented.
Nolan?
No. No way.
What brought us to this? Military might? Are we scared of nuclear power from North Korea? What got us here?
In terms of
the
Trump,
meeting, the planned meeting.
Right. Okay. Well, I think probably the biggest trigger has been really since 2016, when North Korea has been testing missiles and then nuclear weapons underground, really ramping up since 2016, and then in 2017. They tested what some people believe may have been their first test of an H-bomb or a hydrogen bomb. And so that has really put a lot of pressure. And don't forget, Obama also very strongly reacted with new sanctions, but a new framework for sanctions in 2016. And then Trump, especially through the Treasury, has been imposing a lot of financial and other types of sanctions for those that engage with North Korea. So that's really the period. We've had a long history of this, but this has really been a sharp uptick from 2016 and 17.
Len Cutler, there have been sanctions and more sanctions, as at my count, 10 rounds since January of 2013. Is this about sanctions, or is this about a carrier group sitting right off North Korea?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. I certainly agree with what was said by my colleague in terms of the background. But very definitely, there has been heightened sanctions placed against Kim and his regime, and specifically the role provided by China and President Xi in terms of further placing pressure on Kim and his regime And I believe it's had a marked impact in terms of the leader of North Korea having to, in fact, face the consequences of such sanctions.
Our number
for
here,
his nation.
That's Len Cutler. We're also joined by Mark Dallas and Nolan Farenkopf as we talk North Korea and politics in Asia and East Asia. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Oftentimes, Nolan Farenkopf, you hear more or less the phrase, what is left to sanction in North Korea? What hasn't been sanctioned?
I mean, there really isn't a lot. I mean, the UN sanctions from the Security Council have been quite extensive, and the U.S. unilateral sanctions are quite extensive as well. The North Korean regime, though, has become very, very adept at busting sanctions, mm-hmm. whether through it's the trade of small arms and other light weapons, particularly in East Africa. Recently, there was an article that highlighted Egyptian and North Korean cooperation in the sale of small arms, light weapons, rockets, and other advanced military systems through the North Korean embassy in Cairo. The North Korean regime is also very, very adept of taking advantage of brokers and front companies to import military equipment and hardware that have really fueled their missile proliferation activities, both abroad and at home, and their nuclear weapons program. So actually, one of the recent missile tests last year, the U.S. was able to find the wreckage of the missile, and the missile including components from U.S. companies, European companies, Chinese companies, Japanese companies, and even South Korean companies. So North Korea does a very, very good job of getting around sanctions and getting around export control lists put in place by the United States and other partner nations.
Could I add something, though? I think one indication, I'm actually a believer in sanctions, and I think there is more to sanction. But in the most recent years, since 2016, you know, we've really been focusing on natural resources mm-hmm. a lot around the world, and especially China. So in 2017, China basically said, we're not allowing any more coal imports from North Korea, which mm-hmm. is, you know, one of their critical exports. Things that could potentially be continued to be sanctioned is, you know, the offshore banking accounts that mm-hmm. North Korea utilizes for hard currency to pay, you know, its elites as well as its soldiers. So, you know, if we want to crack down on offshore activities like that, that's, you know, that's something that we potentially have the prerogative to do. But there is there's a relative pattern when sanctions kick in and when North Korea starts to feel them, they sometimes come to the bargaining table. And that was the case. Well, in the 1990s, it's a little bit different because they were also suffering from a famine, so they needed a lot of help. But certainly in the most recent round, there's been a very strong uptick of types of sanctions. Some sanctions are weak and useless, and others can be quite targeted and pinpointed in terms of what they need, given that their economy is so weak.
They need hard currency, do they not?
They do. You know, they, well, yes. I mean, it's an economy that is, you know, it's very closed in a lot of ways, but it's still reliant on certain key features that it needs externally, types of, and it has to export in order to earn that hard currency as well. So the sanctions are not just about, you know, weaponry and things like that, but it's about its capacity to earn hard currency in order to, you know, buy things that it cannot produce internally, particularly for its weapons systems and whatnot, but, you know, for other necessities as well.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Mark Dallas, an associate professor at Union College, Len Cutler, political science professor at Siena College, and Nolan Farenkopf, who is a doctoral candidate in the political science department at the University at Albany. And again, nice of you guys to be here today. Anybody have optimism that something groundbreaking as far as denuclearization can occur if the talks actually happen in May? Len?
Well, I think the talks will occur. I'm fully optimistic, and I'm confident that the two leaders will meet. Where they meet and how far these talks go, there's a distinction between dialogue, talking, and negotiations leading to agreements.
You make a great point. When these high-level talks come, usually there are many low-level talks leading up to them.
Proceeding, that's correct.
Not this time.
Well, probably not. There may be some advance meetings in the next 6 to 7 weeks, on the part of State Department officials and, you know, Pompeo and company and some Defense Department and Commerce and others from the administration who will be involved as part of the advance team representing the Trump administration. But quite frankly, I don't see a full summit session occurring. My colleagues may disagree with me at this May meeting, and that's why I'm using the term talks, because I think it will be an opening salvo, hopefully, optimistically, leading to further negotiations, which may produce executive agreements, even possibly down the road, some formal treaty between the two nation states.
I think so. That's excellent. I agree with a lot of what Len said. But from the Korean side, the North Korean side, I don't see any optimism in terms of denuclearization.
No,
I mean, that was your original question
with
denuclearization. It's very hopeful from the American side and much of the rest of the world, including China, for denuclearization. But if you look at the pattern of North Korean activity from the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989 and what happened in the 1990s, they've consistently played cat and mouse.
Yeah.
They've broken many agreements, including the nuclear non-proliferation treatment.
Early 2000s, that's correct.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The early 2000s again, six-party talks and afterwards and on and on. If you have to think of it from their perspective or from Kim's and, you know, the military elite's perspective, is that these nuclear weapons are their key to security. Mm. I mean, they know you wouldn't give up, you know, complete security, and nuclear weapons is the key. So
I wasn't suggesting that, however, in terms of my comments.
Right,
not
no,
that I
know. Yes, you had excellent comments about the United States side, but from the Korean side, they will not give up nuclear weapons, in my opinion, and I don't
They might accept a freeze, but they're not going to go to the denuclearization stage where they give up their weapons. I fully concur.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a quick break here. We're joined today by Len Cutler, Mark Dallas, and Nolan Farenkoff, and we talk North Korea, and your calls are coming up at 800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Gazebo, Northampton, Massachusetts, an independent lingerie shop specializing in bra and post-mastectomy fittings, providing support to the Pioneer Valley for almost 40 years, the-gazebo.com. Innovative Therapy Solutions, LLC in Great Barrington, offering yoga and mindfulness-based groups for children and teens to reduce stress and increase focus, social skills, and other groups are also offered, 413-528-8888. Schenectady County Historical Society, featuring the Mabee Farm, Museum, Research Library, and now the Brower House, presenting programs, changing exhibitions, walking tours, workshops, and more. SchenectadyHistorical.org for information. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. AGStewardship.org. And New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. President Trump says he'll meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in May, and to talk about that, we have Mark Dallas of Union College, Len Cutler of Siena College, and Nolan Farenkoff, who is a doctoral candidate at the University at Albany. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-348-2551. So much of a meeting on the big stage between two world powers, especially ones who don't talk very often, is theatrics and show. And why was it so important to North Korea to have one-on-one talks and not Group of Six or China and the U.S. and North Korea? Why? Why just one-on-one?
Because I think, if I could chime in here for a moment, I think that, in fact, Kim is looking to be recognized as primus inter pares, first among equals, with the President of the United States. Given what Mark was saying before in terms of the testing, the nuclear testing, and the success that his nation has achieved in the past 15, 16 months. He feels, okay, my sense is, I certainly don't know this for a fact, but my sense is he has more bargaining power, more leverage power at the negotiating table to meet one-on-one with the leader of the free world, Donald Trump.
Do you think that President Trump instinctively understands that?
I think he does. I truly believe he does.
And he can play that, perhaps, to his advantage? Or
He has the potential to play it to his advantage.
You want to chime in, Nolan?
Oh, no, I just want to say I absolutely agree. I think that one-on-one talks with the leader of the United States signals that North Korea has joined the nuclear club. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you want it to happen or not, it's happened. You know, yep. A lot of experts claim, and the U.S. Intelligence Committee argues that North Korea could have around 60 nuclear weapons and numerous advanced missiles, mm-hmm. with the ability to deliver these weapons potentially. And that, just like Glenn said, these one-on-one talks give North Korea the prestige in the international system that I think the North Korean regime has really been looking for.
But Mark Dallas, China's still the 800-pound gorilla in the room, right?
Absolutely. So China is critical here. And I think with China, you do have to understand that China's objectives are almost identical to North Korea's, in the sense that North Korea, what does North Korea want? North Korea, or Kim and North Korea, I'm going to use them interchangeably. Mm-hmm. They want the United States out of the Korean Peninsula.
Yep.
Which won't happen.
No.
Well, I can't predict the future, but, you know, we'll see. Probably
nuclear
not.
Nuclear well, forces may go.
Nuclear force, well, if Possible. what if we get to the point where the North can, and we believe, credibly believe, that the North can strike New York City and L.A.? Are you willing to say we're going to still keep our troops there, even though we believe he may actually act in that way? Is it worth it to the American public to sacrifice, make that potential sacrifice? And that's where this game gets very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. But we can get to that in a second, but let me just talk about China real quick. China's got the same objectives as North Korea, which is, again, getting the United States completely out of all of the Korean Peninsula, mm-hmm. reunifying the Korean Peninsula under a friendly nation, meaning the North.
North Korea.
Okay, North Korea. Mm-hmm. And so that they can have that strategic control there. The only thing they disagree on is the nuclear weapons that the North is using to do it. Mm-hmm. China would prefer not to have this be a nuclear-armed state. So they don't want the North to be nuclear. Okay, it's mm-hmm. in China's interest not to have that. But in every other category, you know, having the North perceive the United States as the enemy is also something that China loves. They don't mm-hmm. want to create a nuclear armed enemy on their border, and that their relationship is not guaranteed by anything, right? That it's just purely their history and their common interests that are having them bound together.
Well, there are some economic interests, yeah.
Not much. Oh, for China, North Korea's.
But China could literally put them in a stranglehold.
They could, and they've been playing with it. You know, certainly they go on and off, hot and cold with it. And, you know, like I mentioned earlier, the banning coal exports to mm-hmm. Korea was a pretty significant move. But China is playing a strategic game because what they're basically saying is we don't want this to escalate too much. We don't want the U.S. to now propose putting nuclear weapons in South Korea or mm-hmm. to propose adding missile systems in more and more of the THAAD missile systems in South Korea. So China has to give a little every so often in order to appease most of the United States, but maybe Japan and others, most of the United States, to make sure this doesn't escalate in a way that disturbs the status quo. So that's just a little gift that China gives every so often.
Mark, if I could add to what
sure.
you just said, it would seem to me that Xi and China are also very concerned that Kim could become too cozy with Trump and mm-hmm. the United States if, in fact, this series of talks mm-hmm. leads to a kind of honeymoon between the two leaders. That's the last thing China wants.
Absolutely.
Is
yeah.
a North Korea that becomes an ally of the United States. And there has been some discussion in the literature that Kim really wants a treaty,
right.
A mutual treaty agreed upon by the United States and Korea, North Korea. Mm-hmm. The other point I would raise is with respect to Japan as well as South Korea, because Japan's a player here as well. And very definitely, the United States would be concerned about Japan's position vis-a-vis United States military withdrawal from the Korean Peninsula and the areas surrounding Japan.
Mm. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Mark Dallas, Nolan Farenkopf, and Len Cutler here. Let's go to the phones. Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Rex Tillerson, as head of Exxon, was the top predator fossil dinosaur. His departure would be very welcome, except that Pompeo is worse on energy and worse on relations with the Islamic world. He was literally the congressman from Koch Industries, which was in his district, Kansas 4. And he was the largest recipient of funds from Koch industry. And he's even more of a climate science denialist than Rex Tillerson, who equivocated, although Exxon funded disinformation and denial of the climate science to obscure the scientific consensus.
Do you have a question about North Korea?
So my question about North Korea is that Pompeo has opposed the Iran nuclear deal, which is the best precedent for an effective inspection regime, extremely intrusive, that could actually verify denuclearization if an agreement could be reached. It's sort of a comment more than a question.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Well, let's put it out to the panel, and thank you, Mark. Go ahead.
Okay, you want me to start?
Please feel free.
I don't disagree with what you were saying vis-a-vis the relationship that Mike Pompeo had with the Koch brothers. I would also reference the relationship that he shares with the President of the United States. He is very personally trusted by Donald Trump. He was one of the first members of Congress. I think he was the first House member to endorse the candidacy of Donald Trump, actively campaigned for him, and in fact has his inner ear, if so to speak, on a daily basis, not only with the briefings, but with respect to the personal security discussions that he has with Donald Trump. Rex Tillerson did not share that relationship with the president at all, and this break, if you will, this ousting of Tillerson has been in the works for months.
Almost since the beginning.
This is not an overwhelming shock with respect to the change in the White House by any means for the Secretary of State. So I think the president is comfortable having Mike Pompeo as a principal security advisor as well as his chief diplomatic advisor going into the Korean negotiations, or as I said, Korean talks, dialogue.
I would also add that so Rex Tillerson, he's much more of a diplomat of the two, at least. Rex Tillerson's much more of a diplomat than Mike Pompeo, in particular with North Korea. Rex's view on North Korea was essentially, you know, don't do anything or we will respond. At least that's his public statements and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Mike Pompeo has been more of a, you know, we want regime change. And, you know, Mike Pompeo is more, I mean, he was a congressperson, but then more in the intelligence world. Obviously, Rex Tillerson comes from, you know, a global business who has had to interact with foreign leaders, Russia and whatnot, and so has a sense of diplomacy. So if this is going to shift to a diplomacy thing, I think that's bad news incorporating Mike Pompeo. Now, maybe Mike Pompeo has diplomatic skills we don't know of, and, you know, they'll come out, but...
Well, diplomatic skills don't seem to have done much over the last 50 years in North Korea.
But this is what the meeting presumably is going to be about, not just saber rattling. If the two of them are going to get together, there's going to be diplomacy going on.
But Mark,
of sorts.
As the president has said, and I know he's flippant, but as he has said, I am my own best diplomat. You know, one of the major criticisms of Trump, if you go back to the early part of his administration, is all the vacancies in the top diplomatic department of his cabinet, and that's state, as we well know, Mark.
I totally...
And what he said is, I don't need him.
Right.
I don't need him. I'm the diplomat. I'm the chief diplomat, and I can handle it.
I totally agree with that. But in terms of getting real positive outcomes...
I don't disagree.
It's a different... Yeah, right, exactly. I thought so. You know, you need that... And don't forget, Trump also gutted the State Department.
Yeah,
I think they cut their budget by 30% or something like that. So, you know, you're going in with extremely weak organizational capacity, mm-hmm. and we're riding purely the personality of two people. And so, you know, that doesn't bode well, but at the same, on the other hand, it breaks up the history of how this has happened, and maybe we need a little shaking of how it's happened in the past. I don't know.
Yeah. I think one thing a lot of experts have been concerned about is that, especially under Tillerson, and I think you hit the nail on the head, Len, about how Trump really dislikes and maybe even distrusts the State Department, is that the Policy Planning Committee of the State Department has really cut out a lot of the experts from underneath, and that a lot of the direct action from the State Department on these high-level matters is coming not from experts, from policy experts and regional experts from within the State Department. It's coming from higher-level political appointees or figureheads.
That point well taken, Nolan.
Our number is 800-348-2551 if you want to chime in. 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. President Trump set to meet sometime in May with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. How much? Now, remember, Donald Trump never held an office, at least as far as I know, in government. How much, not tutoring, but how much does he need to know if he's going with for one-on-one talks with a leader of another nation? How much actual prepping will he need?
I don't think much. I mean,
really?
I don't think he's gone in, generally gone in with much. If this is going to be a photo op, if this is going to be, from North Korea's standpoint, this could be a delay tactic purely to get by more time, to test more and whatnot, which is my suspicion as to why they've acted the way they have. It's purely pushing off until we can really confirm we're a nuclear power.
Have they made a test since we have now two carrier groups nearby, right? Have they made any test since then?
No, their tests are not frequent or common. I believe underground nuclear tests, I think they're up to seven now, starting in 2006. Mm-hmm. Missile tests, I don't keep track of those quite as much in terms of how many times they've lobbed missiles over into the Sea of Japan and whatnot. Again, looking at their track record from the 1990s, there's a clear pattern of, sort of test and saber rattling and then be kind and pretend there's going to be negotiations and get everyone hopeful around the world, and then they renege on it. I mean, you go on and on. And so if history is any indication, I'm pessimistic, but I'm willing to have an open mind.
I think this president, as distinct from his immediate predecessor, who was a law professor and had
measured,
a sense
was
of,
measured.
Very measured. Well, critics suggest he was too measured, and that's a topic for another day, and placed very severe constraints on his decision-making military strategic apparatus in the White House, particularly his defense advisors. And I mean, the feud with Gates and company goes well into detail about President Obama certainly weighing all alternatives and very much liking to be briefed by many different sources and many different parties in terms of his national security and military establishment before these kinds of sessions. And I agree with Mark. This president is distinct, and he doesn't want the extensive briefing books, his predecessor certainly got into. And, very sharp and former student of mine was Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Mike Dempsey. And Mike shared with us when we did a visit down there last year to the White House what he would provide the president on a daily basis. He actually showed us one of the briefing books, which was declassified
hopefully
at that point.
Yeah.
And very definitely, this president is a night and day difference. And Pompeo has even made that clear, that this president doesn't want to be deluged with tons of information. As he says himself, I'm a quick learner, and I don't need to be presented multiple data and alternative scenarios. That's not me.
It's a personality, a meeting of two personalities, and perhaps if they end up liking each other or bonding, they have the capacity to start to change things in their respective, I'll call them administrations, but particularly Kim. I mean, he could switch things on a dime and get things in order and whatnot. I don't know if they like each other at a gut level, maybe, but I'm not expecting much more than that.
No, I think I agree. I think if you look at the whole reason why North Korea wanted nuclear weapons and wanted this deterrent capability to begin with, those reasons haven't changed. The original demands for a nuclear deterrent haven't changed since the policy of Chuche was installed by his grandfather in the 50s. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It hasn't changed, so I don't see it changing now.
But what has changed is we now have a president who went in front of the United Nations and said, listen, if we have to, we'll wipe them off the face of the earth. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a fundamental change in the dynamics of the relationship?
I don't think so. I think North Korea has been operating under the assumption that they could be invaded by the United States since the Korean War.
But here's a guy going before the United Nations saying, well, you know, it could happen. It might happen.
I don't know. I think that, if anything, like you said earlier, that gives them more reason to hold on to them and to mm-hmm. stall until they can really prove. Right now, they have proved that they have a limited number of ballistic missiles that could hit the United States. Could
correct.
They hit the United States accurately?
Could,
no
correct.
One's really sure. Can the warhead survive reentry? We're not really sure yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. This is a stall tactic until North Korea can prove, hey, not only do we have these missiles that we can put nuclear warheads on, they can survive reentry and they can hit the White House if we want them to.
Gentlemen, we have to take a quick break here. Len Cutler is here, Mark Dallas and Nolan Farenkopf, and we talk North Korea. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551, and we'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Veterinary Hospital of Laura Lynn Brown, Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, providing comprehensive care for dogs and cats for over 25 years. New clients welcome, drlauralynnbrown.com. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. Water Wheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more, waterwheelvillage.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts. For over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repairs, including tire pressure, exhaust, brakes, and checking engine lights, full-service gas station, collegestreetmotors.com. And Hudson Wine Merchants, a wine and spirits boutique in the heart of Hudson, New York. Curbside service and delivery available. Hudson Wine Merchants, raise your glass. HudsonWines.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Nolan Farenkopf, Mark Dallas, and Len Cutler. And we talk about North Korea with Jeremy in Chatham. Jeremy, you're on.
Hi. You know, I can't get this out of my mind what Henry Kissinger said about this, that how dangerous it was for two leaders to meet and discuss things of substance one-to-one personally, because he said, you know, if the personal part of it goes wrong, then the whole problem has become personalized and becomes much worse, mm-hmm. and it's no longer strategic or whatever. And given the Trump and his lack of preparation and impetuousness, do you see this as a legitimate concern?
Anybody who wants to go first?
I see it as a potential downside, very definitely. This is Len Cutler, and I agree with former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger in that regard.
Yeah,
that is something you chance
right.
when you go into these kinds of talks, and if it just doesn't materialize, leading away to positive developments for more negotiations.
Could it be any more negative?
What do you mean? What negative?
In other words, the relationship is not a sweetie pie kind of thing.
You can only go up, basically. It can only get
better. I'm not sure. I'm asking you. Could it get worse?
It could. Yeah, I think it could. I mean, it could return to saber rattling mm-hmm. and bluster and whatnot.
Yes.
And to pick up a point that was raised before the break, we also have to remember it's not just nuclear weapons, that North Korea has got a huge arsenal of
yes.
other weaponry, and Seoul is only, I think, 40 miles away.
Yep. Correct.
So you've got 10 million people living 40 miles away from the border. So this whole idea of the United States with preemptive strike or will attack them and bluster, I mean, that's the other thing that's keeping Kim safe is saying, you know, unless you're going to sacrifice this enormous population, that you can't wipe that out in an hour. that you would need for a preemptive strike. So that's another thing that, and so that it can get worse because it's not just about nuclear weapons being shot. It's about all out war that could devastate lots of South Korea and Japan. I mean, they're close enough for other types of.
Any of you guys play poker?
Yes.
You guys play poker?
I don't.
And so
I don't either.
Part of it is reading your opponent.
Yes.
And knowing what angle you're going to play. And I would assume that if you're reading Kim Jong-un, as strange as that might be, I would say self-preservation has to be one of his main motivations here.
Yeah, I'd preface this by saying I play poker very poorly.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, let's play.
But yeah, I think primary is self-preservation. And that I think Kim Jong-un recognizes that a preemptive strike is simply not feasible. The U.S. is not willing to sacrifice what would be millions of South Korean lives and how many Japanese lives as well.
I'm turning that around. I'm saying, would he strike Seoul if he knows that would be the end of Kim Jong-un? That's my poker playing question here.
You're saying if Kim Jong-un feels that there's an end game quick to come, that his end would come, he would strike.
No, he would not strike. In other words, the poker that perhaps is being played here is, listen, you know you're a dead man if you do this. The question is, will you do this?
Right.
His survival instinct as leader of Korea, he's a young man, and he certainly doesn't want to be deposed from power by any stretch of the imagination, Ray. So I think, you know, it's a Darwinian instinct. I want to survive. Yeah. I want to stay in power and, you know, maintain support for my elites, not you know, take care of that elite class.
Right, not
the
people, certainly.
Not the rank and file, but certainly the elite class, which could have a disproportionate impact upon his successful governing and ruling.
And we're not in a sort of mutually assured destruction zone, which is where we were with the Soviets in terms of having enormous...
And still are, with the Russians.
Well, no, I'm sorry, between the United States and North Korea.
Right.
You know, so it is a war that could be quote-unquote won. I mean, everyone will be losers in a sense, but it won't be utter annihilation. So that sort of logic, we're getting there, but that sort of logic is not quite yet in place.
We are joined today by Mark Dallas, who just heard, Len Cutler from Siena College, and Nolan Farenkoff from SUNY Albany. And let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Yes. Ray, what a good program you're having today.
Thank you.
I'd like to make a comment that China's policy of one child per family has led to an excess of males in their population today who cannot find brides. And their brides are coming from North Korea today. So North Korea is using that as a bargaining chip to manipulate China.
Huh. True
That's
or not
my,
true?
Well,
thank you.
Comment.
Thanks a lot.
That's very interesting. I wouldn't say it's a bargaining chip. I think the dynamic you're talking about is correct, actually, and most people actually don't realize that there is an excess of males in China. It's quite severe. A lot of them are being absorbed into the People's Liberation Army, which is Chinese military. The Chinese government realizes there's this imbalance, and they're sort of sucking in all of these extra males and just sort of keeping them employed in the army. In terms of the brides, yes, it's true. A lot of the North Koreans who come into China are female, and they are often marrying Chinese. But I don't think it's a global political issue, and I don't think it's a major...
Still, I like the angle.
Yeah, yes. It's a
not
very,
part
very,
of the real politique,
very clever.
Power
yeah,
politics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to J.D. in Springfield, Massachusetts. J.D., you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much for the program, and I would like to ask about the underground testing, those powerful explosions, the effect that they may have on the geology of the surrounding area, and I'm thinking about the Three Gorges Dam.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point because there were reports of some major landslides and cave-ins around the last round of underground testing.
Was she referring to?
She's still here.
You said Three Gorges Dam, or are you talking about in North Korea?
No, I'm talking about the North Korean explosions, the underground testing that they've been doing, and I think I heard in the news that one was supposed to have been a hydrogen bomb and very powerful.
Right.
So with the effects, but how far is it from Three Gorges Dam, which is in China, engineering project there?
I see what you're saying. No, that's very, very far away. The effects of an earthquake, you know, so when you explode these hydrogen bombs, let's say, and we're not sure it's a hydrogen bomb yet, but if it is, it would be a weak one, I guess. But in any case, I think it was like a, you know, on the Richter scale, like a 6.3 or something like that. So it's like a 6.3 earthquake. But Three Gorges Dam is very, very, very far away. They've probably felt it, but it wouldn't risk that.
Anybody else?
I'm not a geologist, so
okay.
But yeah, I think that's a good guess.
Well, thanks, J.D. We appreciate the call. Our number here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551. Len Cutler is a political science professor at Siena College. Mark Dallas, an associate professor at Union College, specializing in international and comparative political economics, as well as East Asia. Nolan Farenkoff is a doctoral candidate in the political science department at the University of Albany. And we go over to Bruce in Kingston. Bruce, you're on.
Yes, I think that Trump has a special bargaining chip that he can bring with his talks to Kim Il-sung. And taking off on Lawrence Wright's book, The Looming Tower, about Al-Qaeda and the road to 9/11, Trump can tell Kim Il-sung he's willing to build a Trump Tower in Pyongyang and name it after himself and Kim Il-sung.
Yes.
And that would give a guarantee that he won't bomb, because why would he bomb his own tower?
Well, you know, Bruce, I guess there's some logic there. Yeah, Len?
I wouldn't dispute that, Bruce. Certainly the Trump dynasty, the corporate sector of the world, would be in his son's hands. And they would do the negotiating on behalf of the Trump Corporation to establish any new towers in Pyongyang.
And I have to say that Bruce seems to have a very keen sense, Bruce, of the vanity of these two individuals. So I think you might be helpful in the negotiations.
You know, Mark Dallas, you alluded to this earlier in the program, and I want to get back to this, that it's not necessarily in China's interest if this goes very well.
Absolutely, yes. And so, you know, China generally likes the status quo, as do a lot of other countries in the region. I mean, there's a certain comfort zone with the status quo. And you have to realize that, you know, this is big news in the United States because they are now getting closer and closer to being able to destroy American cities. That's why we're, you know, talking about this so much. But this has been going on for decades and decades now.
True.
And Japan and Korea have been under this cloud for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, China, you know, they do like the status quo. They don't like the fact that he's got nuclear weapons and that he's going further and further in that direction and increasing its capabilities. They would have preferred the status quo minus the nuclear weapons in North Korea, but achieving or getting closer to a strategy to try to edge the United States out, because China's interest is really to create a regional zone that it controls militarily and economically. And that includes the region of including Japan and Korea, the Korean Peninsula, as well as, you know, more south in Southeast Asia as well, and to push the American military in particular. Because you got to remember, there's American military, about 30,000 troops in South Korea. There's a good 30 to 40,000 or maybe about 30,000 in Japan. You know, China feels this pressure on a regular basis, let alone, you know, airfields in Guam and whatnot. So we're at the you can't, you know. Where's the closest Chinese base to the American mainland?
Mm-hmm. Len.
No, I just wanted to reaffirm what was just said by Mark. And just as China is concerned about the status quo and maintaining the balance in that part of the region, you can see China as well playing with respect to India and Pakistan, as well as the Afghanistan war that we've been involved in now for the past 17 years, Ray.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. And back to the phones we go. Ken and Tilson. Ken, you're on.
Hi, how you doing? I am really very confused as to why North Korea is considered a threat to the U.S.
Well, we've been talking about the physical threat. Why they are our enemy goes back a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to, you know, the Cold War era, essentially, really 1950. And even as early as January 1950, the United States, Truman and Dean Atkinson, they did not actually consider South Korea and Taiwan to be a future ally or under their umbrella. It wasn't until really June 1950 that things really heat up.
That's when North Korea invaded.
They invaded,
yeah,
that's right.
Parallel,
and
right.
But there were a lot of things going on in that six-month period in which the Cold War really got set in stone. Okay. Mm-hmm. And since then, you know, we were actually the ones to first put low-grade tactical nuclear weapons in the South. We were actually the first ones to nuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
And was it MacArthur who talked of using them?
Yes.
On the battlefield.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, we were, during that era, it was like, yeah, we can use nukes. And we just did in 1945, of course. But, you know, the whole atmosphere of how to adjust to a nuclear world was just being created at that point in time. So everything was on the table, and we've become much more regularized now. But since, you know, then the Soviets started to help the North Koreans to get basic knowledge and training in nuclear weaponry. And that really started in the mid-1950s and the Yongbyon nuclear facilities soon thereafter. So this has got deep, deep roots in the Cold War right from the beginning. Of course, the Korean War, but then the broader Cold War brought it all the way through. But the most, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, then you've got North Korea really saying, oh, my gosh, we have a security dilemma here because our benefactor in terms of economic aid and security just collapsed. They no longer exist. Mm-hmm. And so they had to really push to be able to start to protect themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think to add on to that point is it's important to realize that alliances can also determine how states behave, too. It's not necessarily just your adversary. So one reason why North Korea felt the urge to develop nuclear weapons and to further develop its military arsenal is not necessarily because what the U.S. might have done. It's that Kim Jong-un's grandfather looked at how the Soviet Union really backed down during the Cuban Missile Crisis and realized, well, if we can't trust our allies, who can we trust? Mm-hmm. And it kind of pushed North Korea into this more developing its own nuclear deterrent.
But they were a puppet state, were they not? And so would they even need nukes unless the Russians, the Soviets said, you better have some nukes. Here you go.
You're talking about North Korea?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you also have China nuclearized as well.
Were the Soviets not the prime impetus to nuclearizing North Korea?
They were the prime assistance to it, yes, in terms of technical capability, in those, especially in those early years in the 1950s and 60s. But then you've got China nuclearizing, and you've also got sort of that Cold War established on the 38th parallel, where you've got huge, you know, buildup of conventional weaponry in the South and American tactical nuclear weapons in the South. So if you're North Korea, you know, don't forget, the Soviet Union would also encourage this as well, right, to potentially nuclearize.
This is what I'm saying.
At a low level, right, North Korea as well.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. We're almost out of time, gentlemen. This has been a fast hour. Let's go to Steve in Saugerty. Steve, you're on.
Hi, gentlemen. I'm just a quick question. I'm wondering, isn't this the job of the Secretary of State and not the President of the United States?
I would say traditionally, and I would emphasize the word traditionally, looking at the institution of the presidency, I think we would all agree, correct me if I'm wrong, colleagues, that the Secretary of State and his staff would set the stage for subsequent talks and meetings between the two heads of state.
Mm.
The initial outreach and the initial negotiations would occur at that level. But we're in different times, and we're dealing with different personalities and leaders in Trump and Kim Jong-un.
And this is also why the firing of Rex Tillerson today and bringing in Mike Pompeo just before these things are going to start to get going. I understand the logic, a fresh plate or, you know, a fresh slate to begin with. But that really further disturbs any kind of continuity from an organizational capacity within the State Department.
I agree.
That's already been gutted in terms of its funding. And a lot of career people in the State Department are gone. No one mentioned sort of the loss of, you know, sort of knowledgeable people in the State Department. So you've got a State Department that's
brain drain.
Brain drain and a money drain in a wreck.
20 seconds. Let's gauge our level of optimism. Len.
Our level of optimism. What are you looking for, Ray, in
the
20
meeting.
Seconds?
Will it be anything positive come of it?
I'm hopeful that there will be a start of positivism between these two leaders when they meet.
Nolan.
Not particularly hopeful. I think President Trump is going to go in unprepared, and that Kim Jong-un is going to use that to his advantage to stall and then further develop the technology.
Mark Dallas.
I just think that at least it's going to shake the boat a bit, and maybe there's going to be some slight change. Otherwise, we're going to have what we've had for the past 20, 30 years.
I got to say, guys, this was very educational for me. Really enjoyed it. We're out of time, but thank you very much to Len Cutler, Mark Dallas, and Nolan Farenkopf for being here. Support comes from Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts. Locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement, a proud supporter of public radio, FortHillAutoBody.com. Studio KTM Salon Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color, from corrective to fashion by stylist Kristen Marquette, StudioKTM.com. Kent Hicks Construction, specializing in deep energy retrofits, passive house, zero energy homes, and historic restorations, serving the Berkshires, Massachusetts, Pioneer Valley, Western Massachusetts for over 25 years. KentHicksConstruction.com. Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture, specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients. WindhorseNaturopathic.com. Thanks for being here on Vox Pop. Tomorrow, Pets und Vets. Dr. Ron Scharf will be here right now. Stand by for news.